Broadcasting from the Mono Wind Casino Studios. This is Multicultural AM 1600, KGST, Fresno.
This is a special program on Multicultural 1600 AM, so please stay tuned.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlow Dermagerdichian. My guest today is Dr. Viken Chaterian. He's a Swiss-Lebanese historian, journalist, and author who currently teaches at Webster University in Geneva and also at the University of Geneva. Welcome to the show, Dr. Chaterian.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining us today. You are the author of several books, and you have also had the opportunity to travel throughout the region of Karabakh, Armenia, and even into Azerbaijan. And that's kind of the direction I want to go with you today, is to talk a little bit about that. But maybe you can just start off and talk a little bit about your career first. You were a journalist living in Beirut. I take it you were born in Beirut, or tell us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, that's right. I'm born in Beirut and I grew up in Beirut, a city in war, which marked me very strongly. I spent 15 years of my childhood and early youth years in a war condition. And I also started working as a journalist in Beirut before leaving and traveling to Europe. And shortly after, I went to Armenia, Karabakh. This was early 1992, as a freelance journalist. And then I spent the next basically 15 years covering conflicts and political issues in the Caucasus, South Caucasus, North Caucasus. I've been to Chechnya, I've been to Abkhazia, Dagestan, these places. And later I worked in Central Asia and parts of Russia. And after working as a war correspondent, I also initiated a dialogue process between Armenian, Georgian, Abkhaz, Azeri, Ossetian journalists. For 3 years, I organized 12 meetings in the South Caucasus between journalists coming from different conflict sites. And my intention was to give them the opportunity to learn about how the other side thinks about different issues. And my aim was to enable these journalists to write about their neighbors slash enemies, if you want, in a more concrete, knowledgeable, informed manner. And so we can talk more in more details about this later, maybe. And later I moved on to do my doctoral thesis, which was a comparative study of the conflicts in Karabakh, South Ossetia, Abkhazia, and Chechnya. I think by comparing, you learn more about the single cases. You don't see Karabakh as the center of the world. You contextualize it and you understand that there was a historical process going on and Karabakh was part of it, as well as Abkhazia, Chechnya, and all those other conflicts. And afterwards, I also worked on the Armenia-Turkey historical relations. My latest book is entitled Open Wounds, Armenians, Turks, and the Century of Genocide, which basically traces Armenian-Turkish relations after the genocide and looks at the impact of this mass violence and its denial on the modern history of the Middle East.
And I think that book probably has a lot to say about what's been happening also in Karabakh and in Artsakh and in Armenia and in Azerbaijan, because if you look at that relationship of denial of genocide, somehow I think Azerbaijan has picked up some of that. I mean, in their rhetoric, they talk about still wanting to expand. And so how do you see that? How do you see that denial as part of also this war in Karabakh? Or do you see the connection there as well?
Well, I studied how the genocide influenced the emergence of the Karabakh conflict. And in Open Wounds, but also in later academic articles, I argue that both Armenia and Azerbaijan, as well as Turkey, you know, Turkey's position on Karabakh eventually leads us to the 1915 genocide and the way this this experience was conceptualized, was narrated in these three societies. Armenia tried to, in spite of the genocide, tried to have normal relations with Turkey. So it is surprising maybe, but Armenia did not try to politicize the question of genocide and link it to Karabakh. Armenian policy since the early 90s was to separate these two, to have normal relations with Turkey in spite of the genocide, without pushing for confessions from Turkey and acceptance of the historical fact of genocide. Turkey, however, has put a precondition on Armenia before normalizing relations to have Armenia accepting to give away any effort for international recognition of the genocide. On top of this, Turkey later added, in 1993, added another element, another demand, which was the resolution of the Karabakh conflict based on Baku perspective. So Turkish policies towards Armenia from early 1990s, linked Armenian-Turkish relations with the Karabakh conflict. But what is the most surprising is that Azerbaijan, from basically 1988, from the moment of Sumgayit pogrom, has taken the Turkish denialist narrative and has seen the conflict from this perspective. So when you look at what Azeri intellectuals and eventually officials say, that there's no Sumgayit, nothing happened. And eventually, if something happened, it was organized by the Armenians themselves. So the Azerbaijani historian Ziya Bunyatov has written in 1989 an article saying basically the Armenians organized the pogroms in Sumgayit just to have stronger argument for their territorial demands in Azerbaijan. Not only this, but the whole discourse of genocide has been taken over by Azerbaijan. There's a state law that came out in 1998, which officially commemorates the day of Azerbaijani genocide. And this law presents the last 200 years of Azerbaijan as two centuries of victimhood, where Armenians tried to victimize Azeris. And of course, there's the case of Khojalu massacre, which was a massacre that happened during the war in 1992, where 160 people were killed. And Azerbaijani official discourse takes over this and transforms it into a day of genocide. On the other hand, Azerbaijan very actively denies and kind of sponsors efforts to deny that there was a genocide in 1915 against Ottoman Armenians.
And in fact, they the same Bunyatov and others try to argue that the presence of Azerbaijan extends far into history, right? So that even areas in Artsakh, monuments, churches, are not Armenian churches, but rather churches of the Albanians or others. So they've really taken over that whole argument, haven't they?
Yes, exactly. Bunyatov is the same historian who's the real author of this concept of Armenians being newcomers to what is now Armenia and what is now Karabakh, the mountainous Karabakh. Already in the Soviet times, he wrote books about arguing the idea that all those medieval monuments, they don't belong to the Armenians. They were not constructed by the Armenians, but they were the artifacts developed by this Caucasian people that Armenians call Arvank. In English, it's Caucasian Albanians. And of course, any serious historian would very clearly say that there's no link between what Bunyatov and others are saying and the monasteries in Karabakh, in Armenia, and so on. Yeah, it's a long story.
You were very much there in Armenia in the late 80s and early 90s when the first Karabakh War erupted. Did you think about this before you went there? And the question I want to ask is, did you see an inevitability of conflict? In other words, was everything sort of looking towards this first conflict, moving towards that in your mind? Of course, it deals with the breakup of the Soviet Union, but was there already such hardened positions in that period?
I went for the first time as a journalist to Armenia and Karabakh in 1992, not in the late 80s. And in 1992, it was already, you know, the height of the war. And it was a very brutal war, just like the one now. And at that time, in March, April, when I was in the area, I thought that there was only the logic of war that had to play out before entering a period of ceasefire and negotiations and so on. But going back to the early 1988, I do not think that it was inevitable to come to a conflict and a violent conflict. In fact, when you look at the way the Armenian side, Karabakh Armenians, articulated and put forward their demands, I don't think they were looking for a conflict. They used existing Soviet institutions. So they were very much legalist. So they used the legal mechanism that were there, and they used the Soviet institutions that were there. On top of this, they thought that their demand was totally matching the spirit of perestroika and glasnost. Let's not forget that, you know, this was the Soviet Union, its superpower, and it was the period of reforms. You know, this was the height of Gorbachev reforms. So no, it was not written that this conflict will take this path. But I think the way the pogroms in Sumgayit happened for 3 days, you know, groups of young men armed with sticks and chains, they attacked Armenians, brutalized them, killed many of them. And the fact that this was not stopped and this was not punished harshly opened up the Pandora's box to more violence and moved the conflict from being a political conflict that we might have in everyday life, right? We often have political conflicts, but to move from political conflict to a violent intercommunal conflict, this was done, I think, as a result of Sumgayit pogrom and the lack of justice and punishment in the case of Sumgayit.
And when did you go to Baku, you said, or on these journalism trips? What years were those?
So I started organizing exchanges between journalists. In the idea and the first contacts I took was in 1996. So this was just 2 years after the ceasefire in the first war. And in 1997, I managed to organize the first couple of meetings in Georgia. We met in Tbilisi first and then in Kutaisi. And then in October 97, I managed to invite a group of 5 Azeri journalists to come to Yerevan, Armenia. And what I did was, for 2 days, we did professional workshops to talk about journalism, how journalism is changing, the challenges. And then we took two, three additional days to meet with local politicians, leaders, opposition figures, intellectuals, so that the journalists who traveled would go back with rich material, establish contacts with colleagues, with politicians. And the whole intention was to create links, to create dialogue, to create exchange. Afterwards, I just to go back to the October 97 event, you know, I'm a diaspora Armenian, and in Azerbaijani propaganda, it's the worst that can happen, right? And the fact that 5 Azeri journalists, based on my initiative and my invitation, they had the courage to come to Armenia, not just to go to the other side, but also to take the risk to be labeled, you know, traitors and those who went to the other side to meet with the enemy. So I have great respect to this Azeri journalists back in the 90s. that they had the courage to do this kind of work. And then in 98, we even went to Karabakh. They were five or six. Among them, one was born in Shusha in Azeri. And this was very tense and very emotionally charged event. And Baku was in June 1999, where I went to Baku with a group of journalists from Yerevan, from Karabakh. And apart from meeting the journalists, we met with Azeri president Heydar Aliyev, the father of the current president. We met on a number of occasions his foreign affairs advisor, Vafaguluzadeh. We met with the foreign minister, Tofik Zulfugarov. We met opposition figures, Issa Gampar and others. And it was extremely rich. You know, I learned a lot. And I think many of the journalists learned a lot. What is really unfortunate is that later on, these kind of initiatives became more and more difficult. Traveling to Azerbaijan became impossible for Armenians. Simply having IAN at the end of your surname was enough to be arrested and deported. Most of my Azeri colleagues could not come and talk to us in Yerevan or even meet with us in Tbilisi. And in the end, most of the Azeri scholars, lawyers, journalists ended up either in prison in Azerbaijan and living to live in exile in Europe. So the dialogue we started in the late 90s was broken.
And that's the question I was going to ask, because these journalists, were they open at least to listening to the view of Armenians and to kind of see how Armenians were looking at the same types of issues in your own conversations with these journalists?
I mean, the intention was not to teach Azeris or Armenian perspective. It was the idea was to give opportunity for all parties to learn about the other. It was not just to teach Azeris what the Armenians think, but also to give an opportunity to Armenians to understand how Azeris think. Eventually, even if you think that what they are thinking is wrong, they are your neighbor, and you have to consider their thoughts, their fears, their hopes, their frustrations. And it was curious. I had the chance of working on this for a relatively long period, 3 years, and I organized 12 such meetings. And in the beginning, in the first two meetings, they were very polite to each other, extremely polite. And then I remember the third meeting was in a mountain resort in Georgia. And after the workshop in the evening, in the hotel lobby, drinking beer, suddenly they started fighting. They started, you know, going back to, I don't know, 2,000 years back, which king was, which village was on which side and so on. Me, initially, I thought, I mean, they are crazy. What are they talking about, you know? This medieval history, ancient history, what does this have to do with our day's life? But then I understood that it was important for them to say whatever they had to say to the other side. And after that, they were not polite with each other anymore. They were friends. They collaborated. They started working with each other. They were honest. They were open. And I think Armenians and Azeris need such space, not only to be polite to the other, not only to be aggressive to the other, but also to go over the period of aggression and to start working with each other. Because eventually they were journalists. Journalists in Baku, journalists in Yerevan, journalists in Tbilisi, and they have common interests. They are not just ethnic Armenians and ethnic Azeris and ethnic Abkhaz. They are also professionals, right? And as professionals, we can collaborate. And by collaboration, we can create a new dynamism, a new space, where the conflict and whether 2,000 years back this village was Azeri or Armenian and Caucasian Albanian or whatever becomes less and less important.
My guest today is Dr. Viken Chaterian. We've been discussing events happening in Armenia and a little bit about his background as a historian and journalist. We're going to take a quick break on All Things Armenian, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome back to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlo Demirgadichian. My guest today is Professor Biken Chaterian, and we're talking about a lot of different aspects of what's happening, been happening in Armenia and Karabakh. You've also, however, studied the color movements, so-called color movements in the Arab world, the changes that have swept through the Arab world. And I'm wondering, you've also, of course, looked at what's happened in Armenia with the so-called Velvet Revolution. Do you have any thoughts about that? How that ties in with what was happening in the rest of the world and the rise of Pashinyan and how that may fit in?
Well, the Arab Spring, I worked on it quite intensively in 2011 and the next years. And also before that, I studied and I worked on the color revolutions. So I did an edited book on the color revolutions. I've done field studies in Serbia, Ukraine, Georgia, and Kyrgyzstan to look at the outcome of this nonviolent regime changes in post-Soviet and post-socialist republics. Now, Armenia in 2018 is very curious. It's a very curious event because it's an isolated event. When you look at the broader context of Armenia, you see that Armenia managed to overthrow the former head of the state, that the big part of the public opinion thought he was trying to stay in power in an illegitimate manner. And this transformation, this overthrowing of the old ruler, took place by popular mobilization and popular pressure without any violence. But when we look at Azerbaijan, Turkey, and Russia, but also Iran, we see that the context of Armenia was not in a mood of change, of popular mobilizations, of democratization, and regime change. In Iran, there was a similar movement, popular protest at least, for social problems because of public opinion thinking that the current regime in Iran is illegitimate and so on, but it was crushed. In Azerbaijan, since 2003, so it's been 17 years, Ilham Aliyev is in power. I think it's his fourth or fifth mandate. And he inherited his post from his father. So we see that to the east of Armenia, the reality is very different. In Turkey, we have not only Recep Tayyip Erdogan in power since also 2003, but also concentration of power is increasing in Turkey. So now Erdogan is not the prime minister of Turkey with well-defined authority, but he has absolute power where he can put anyone in prison, where he can decide on war and peace, and so on. Russia, the same. We have Putin in power since the year 2000 with the with one exception where Medvedev being president for 4 years. So we see that Armenia and Armenian leaders should have been much more careful, because it's one thing to be part of a broader movement of change, democratization, pro-liberal movement, but it's another thing to be a kind of marginal case, an isolated case, as it is in Armenia.
And did that then have an effect, you think, on this recent war in the Artsakh-Karabakh war, Azerbaijan? In other words, the changes that were happening in Armenia, this liberalization, perhaps Russia saw this as something which was potentially threatening and perhaps didn't support Armenia, didn't support Karabakh as much. You think, in terms of the democratization, you know, it happened, and then Pashinyan, prime minister, began to look a little to the west. I think maybe too much for the liking of Russia.
I think there's an element of that, because for 44 days, Russia stayed neutral in a war where Azerbaijan was attacking a country which legally is a military ally of Russia. On top of this, Azerbaijan had invited Turkey and invited foreign mercenaries from Syria and elsewhere to be part of this war. And I think Russia had quite a number of reasons to interfere in this war. But the fact that Pashinyan was not maybe his favorite Armenian leader could have influenced Russian decisions to wait for that long. But also, I think the color revolution or the Velvet Revolution in Armenia in 2018 also caused Yerevan's change of attitude towards the Karabakh conflict and towards Azerbaijan. You know, revolutionaries usually overestimate their force. It's a psychological thing, right? Once you manage to overthrow the old regime, you have a feeling of being invincible. You have a feeling of being, you know, the center of the planet. And I think Pashinyan, who managed a miracle in 2018 to bring down, you know, the old regime without bloodshed, I think it was not evident, he overestimated his power, his possibilities of working on the balance of power and alliances, and he provoked Azerbaijan, and this was not necessary. And I think he provoked Azerbaijan because he overestimated his capabilities, diplomatic, strategic, and military. And I think he didn't need to change the status quo on Karabakh, because his mandate was to be prime minister was not based on promises to bring any change in Karabakh. In fact, when you look at opinion polls in Armenia last year, the Karabakh question was way down the list of different matters that Armenian public opinion thought urgent. Karabakh, I think, was the fifth or the sixth. And of course, the top priority was fighting corruption, the social economic situation, the question of democratization in Armenia. And this was the mandate of Nikol Pashinyan. So he didn't need to make different and contradictory declarations on the Karabakh issue. First, talking about bringing in the Karabakh de facto state in the negotiations, which might sound something very nice, very good, right? It might sound very democratic, but within the logic of Karabakh negotiations, within the diplomatic logic, it was a dead end. Because it was evident that Baku was going to say, no, you don't want Karabakh Armenians on the negotiation table. It's been years we are negotiating all types of formats and without the Karabakh Armenians. So now if you bring them to the table of negotiations, it would become a provocation for Baku, and this would put an end to the negotiations. And once you stop negotiations, what's the alternative?
That's war.
Well, yeah, exactly.
When you've studied these the Arab Spring and the color revolutions, I suppose in a sense we judge their success on the ability for establishing democratic system or institutions to see if they can last for a long time. Have they, by and large, done so? Been successful in your opinion? And what does that bode for Armenia in terms of its Velvet Revolution and its progress in terms of moving towards that?
No, the Velvet Revolutions, the color revolutions in Eastern Europe, took place because the electoral system was blocked. The old regimes were cheating, were falsifying electoral results to stay in power. On top of this, there was another problem where for the big part of the public opinion, they were corrupt. So these are the two slogans in Serbia, in Ukraine, in Georgia, in Kyrgyzstan and in Armenia that brought the Velvet Revolutions. But when we look at Serbia 20 years later, is Serbia less corrupt and more democratic? When you ask the Serbian opposition, they would tell you no. Last year, in 2018 and 2019, there was continuous demonstrations in the streets of Belgrade asking for democratization and opposing the current president and his corrupt policies, as they saw. In Georgia, we have just now, right, after the parliamentary elections in October, we have a political crisis in Georgia. This shows that the electoral system maybe took a step ahead, but we can't talk about full-fledged democracy in Georgia after the 2003 revolution. In Ukraine, after the first revolution, a second, the Maidan, Euromaidan revolution took place in 2014. This shows that the initial Orange Revolution did not fulfill its promises. In Kyrgyzstan, we have the third revolution. So this shows that just having a revolution and regime change and putting aside the old elite and bringing instead of them a new bunch of people to take power in itself is not enough to have full-fledged developed democratic institutions. And the crisis in all these countries is continuing today.
So we could expect, it's going to be a few years of potential more change in Armenia. I mean, obviously the political turmoil now with the end of the war, the agreement, and with Pashinyan is going to lead to, we don't know, but it's going to be very interesting, isn't it, in terms of which new people emerge too, leaders emerge in Armenia.
Yes, exactly, and I didn't think that the political architecture that resulted from the 2018 revolution and the elections that that followed did not create enough balance and counterbalance, checks and balances within the Armenian parliament to hope for democracy to emerge. There was too much concentration of power within the hands of Mr. Pashinyan and his political group. They dominated over the parliament, they dominated over the executive, and they were trying to take full control of the judiciary. When you have one power, you don't have democracy. At least you have to have duality of power so that one negotiates with the other. And this is this process of negotiation, we have institutionalized it and we call it the parliament. But when you have only one power dominating over the parliament, they don't need to negotiate. Negotiate with whom?
Now, you've written a book. I want to talk about a little bit about the Open Wounds book, The Armenians and Turks in a Century of Genocide. And you mentioned it a little bit, but tell us, you also included in there the story of Hrant Dink. So can you tell us how that tied into the story and some of the basic points you were making in the book?
Yes, the book, well, the basic idea of the book was to talk about not the genocide itself, but what we inherited from this experience. And when we look at the Armenian genocide, the most interesting element in it is that for maybe 8 decades, it was censored, forgotten, and denied. And the question I'm asking in this book, what happens to a society? And by this society, I'm thinking about the post-Ottomans. So Turks, Kurds, Armenians, Syrians, Iraqis, Lebanese, because the genocide concerns all of them. It happened in their country. And the country back then was the Ottoman Empire. So with censoring and denying the genocide, the question I'm asking is, what is the impact of this event, the genocide, on societies they don't see that such a huge crime has taken place in their country? So the whole book with 13 different chapters is kind of an investigation to answer this question. And I start with Hrant Dink because I think Hrant is pivotal in bringing the debate about the Armenians, their existence, their fate back to Turkey and back to Turkish public opinion.
And so what was his position? What was Hrant Dink's position? What was he trying to do in Turkey with the question of genocide or just Armenian-Turkish relations?
I mean, Hrant started from a very basic idea that I think it was 1994. This was the height of the Karabakh conflict. In the Turkish media, Armenians were presented as villains, as nasty people. Plus, there was media campaigns linking PKK and PKK leader Abdullah Öcalan to Armenians, reducing the Kurdish question to being hidden Armenians and so on. And next to this, there was no Armenian voice within the Turkish society. And what Hrant wanted to say is, brothers, sisters, listen to me, I do exist. I mean, don't listen to these media campaigns that represent an image of Armenians that doesn't exist. The Armenian is me. Listen to me. Let's talk to each other. On the very basic level. Let me talk to your conscience. And by doing this, he started opening one taboo after the other in the Turkish society. Basically, Hrant is the first Armenian to dare to have a public stand within Turkey as an Armenian. And that's why he was assassinated.
Well, we're going to take a quick break on all things Armenian. My guest today is Dr. Viken Chaterian, and we've been discussing a variety of topics covering from Karabakh to a book of his called Open Wounds, Armenians, Turks, and a Century of Genocide. We'll take a brief pause and we'll be back in just a moment.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome back to All Things Armenian. I'm Professor Barlo Demirgradichan. My guest today is Dr. Viken Chaterian, a Swiss-Lebanese historian, journalist, and author. We were talking a little bit about your book, Open Wounds, Armenians, Turks, and a Century of Genocide. let's bring it up to, again, this late 20th century, 21st century. Have things changed in this narrative of genocide? How have they changed, in your opinion, in terms of the Armenian and Turkish relationship? Have any positions changed in the way that they speak to each other?
Well, they changed a bit, at least in Turkey. When we look, Turkish intellectuals, academics, journalists, not related to the state. I think today, most of them will not ignore the Armenian genocide, will not ignore the Armenian history. It's not just genocide, you know, it's much more than that. There's a huge history that this genocide destroyed. For four centuries, Armenians were an important element within the Ottoman system. For four centuries, 10, 15, 20% of the population of the Ottoman capital were Armenians. So Armenians were very central in the Ottoman Empire. So it's more than just their destruction. You know, we focus too much on this. And I think we have to understand what was the role and what was the place of the Armenians in the Ottoman system, and what changed in the Ottoman Empire to make the Armenians from being the most active supporters of Ottoman reforms, the Tanzimat, to become the enemies to be destroyed. So these are very complex questions, but it's necessary to keep in mind. So in the last 20 years, there was a period of relative openness within the Turkish society, because a new force inspired by political Islam tried to come to power and was challenged by the army. So this duality of power for a while created a space of discussion, of questioning certain stereotypes, certain taboos. And it was during this period that it was possible for the first time in September 2005 to organize a conference in Istanbul to talk about the Armenian genocide. And then the assassination of Hrant Dink triggered huge mobilization in a number of Turkish cities, where Turkish citizens carried slogans saying, "We are all Hrant Dink, we are all Armenian." And they saw that the process of democratization in Turkey has to go through questioning what happened to the Armenians. Why did we expel them, deport them, and massacre them, convert their churches, destroy their schools? Without questioning this mass violence, it's not possible to bring rule of law to Turkey. And I think the democratic movement in Turkey understood this. The only tragedy is that more and more Mr. Erdogan took power and reinforced himself, he made alliances with the deep state. And now there's no duality of power. It's one and the same. And especially after 2014, when the conflict between Erdogan and Gülen, his former Islamist partner, started, and then the failed coup d'etat in 2016, things have gone really very nasty in Turkey. And today we see more and more Turkish political class going back to the very brutal old discourse about the genocide, about its denial, about how great Enver Pasha and other architects of genocide were, and so on.
Well, I'd like to turn the last few minutes of our conversation to the idea of Armenians in the diaspora. And you perhaps are as good an example of an Armenian in the diaspora, having lived in Lebanon, traveled to Armenia, now living in Geneva. What are some of your thoughts about what is happening in the Armenian diaspora, and then also related to the relationship of the Armenians in the diaspora with today's Republic of Armenia? And not only in the context of the war, but in a broader sense, relationships and how Armenians can feel part of that Republic of Armenia. I know it's a big question, but just you've traveled so many places and seen so many different Armenian communities.
It is indeed a big question. Me, I think that Armenians have overemphasized the idea of the nation state. The nation state is a very short part of Armenian experience, Armenian history. I think we are fundamentally a diaspora civilization. And our advantage in relation with any other community, nation, and so on, is that we have this diasporic experience. And I think in the last 30 years, we have not paid enough attention to the Armenian diaspora, its institutions, its media, schools, and I think it's time to rethink about the diaspora, because I think it has a lot to give to Armenia, but it has also a lot to give to humanity in general. I think our diasporic experience is of universal value, much more than Armenia's experience as a nation state.
And a nation state is having boundaries and borders and all of this, whereas Armenians have for now hundreds of years, because of war, genocide, and other reasons, now established their communities throughout the world. So what is the state of the diaspora, however? How do you see it? Is it healthy? Is it need changes? What do you see when you travel?
No, I feel that we have disregarded diaspora, because in the last 30 years, with the emergence of independent Armenia, with the Karabakh issue and the Karabakh question, the earthquake in northern Armenia in 1988, all these things have focalized all Armenian attention, including the attention of Armenian diaspora institutions, political parties, foundations, towards Armenia. So, and today I feel that we are unable to conceptualize the fact that Armenia is part of Armenianness. It's not the totality. And that we have also to think, to discuss, to argue, but also to invest resources, human resources, financial resources, so that diaspora institutions continue and thrive and modernize. My feeling is that in the last 30 years, we have not done enough to keep the diaspora alive. And when I go back and look at history, I mean, Armenian culture, political thinking, political parties, they were all the result of diaspora activities. I mean, the first modern Armenian political party, the first socialist party in the entire Middle East, was founded here in Geneva, not in Armenia. They were seven students, all seven of them coming from the Russian Empire, and they met in Geneva. They were studying in a number of European universities, and they founded the Hanchagian Party. The first Armenian newspaper was published in Madras, in India. Venice, Tiflis, Moscow. I don't know, there are so many cities and Jerusalem, Aleppo, and so on. These are places which are important to understand Armenian history and Armenian culture, and modern Armenian culture specifically. So I think we have disregarded this very important aspect of the diaspora, and I hope that in the coming years we will give more attention to our diasporic identity, culture, and institutions specifically.
And just one final question about you are from Lebanon. What's happening with the Lebanese Armenian community? It's almost been lost in this Karabakh war, because there was the explosion in March, and then the tragedy of the Armenians and everyone in Lebanon. What's happening in Lebanon today? Can you give us a few words about what's happening with the community?
Yeah, I mean, the community there is just like the rest of the Lebanese. First, they are living a very deep financial crisis. Lebanon financially is a bankrupt country. Its banks have no more money. And then there was the explosion which happened in the port of Beirut, and the Armenian neighborhoods of Beirut are not far from there. So today, the Armenian community of Lebanon, which in the past has been an important community, but has lost a lot of its human resources, financial capabilities, today is living huge challenges. And as you said, with the war in Armenia, the attention of the Armenian world as I turn towards Stepanakert, towards Yerevan, and I'm afraid we will not be able to pay enough attention to Beirut and to Lebanon in general.
My guest today has been Dr. Viken Chaterian. We've had a sort of a wide-ranging conversation about his career, about Armenia, Karabakh, Armenians and Turks and their relationship. And I want to thank you very much for joining me today, Dr. Chaterian.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure having you. And for all things Armenian, this is Professor Barlo Demirgardichyan wishing you a good week ahead. And we'll see you next week for another episode of All Things Armenia.
This was a special program on Multicultural 1600 AM.